iRadio, IRDO. Transmitting the frequencies of change across the airwaves of innovation. We are Idaho Talk Radio.
Tea Party Bob, and today we are speaking with Kristi Zinno, Senator from District 23, who is going to discuss several topics that are currently being talked about at the Idaho Legislature. So without further delay, let me welcome Senator Kristi Zinno. And good morning, Kristi, and where would you like to start our conversation today?
Well, good morning, Bob, and thank you for having me on. First, I should clarify that I'm the Senator from District 8. Senator Lakey is now the senator from District 23. So
that's right. It was redistricting, huh?
Since redistricting. Yeah, it's a beautiful morning. I'm just so glad to be alive and so honored to be able to be on this podcast with you and let the people know what happens inside this building. As you well know, sometimes some of the shenanigans could be quite shocking, but here we are.
Well, we've heard a lot of shocking things in the 15, 20 years I've been dealing with the legislature. So there's not much that that would surprise me nowadays.
Well, let's start. If you want, we could start with the resolution that we did, me and, well, the Gang of Eight, we are affectionately called here in the legislature.
Now, the Gang of Eight, that's the conservative group, that kind of like what we had in Congress.
Yeah, kind of like, only we're conservatives, right?
Right, okay. You
know, we consider ourselves the conservative heart of the Idaho legislature. And we crafted a resolution to reject the pay increase. And we actually started talking about this and working on this before I think the committee met in October. And so before many of us, well, all of us were actually officially in office, and even officially sworn in, you know, we started to talk about, no, this isn't the right time. That's a huge increase. Because as you remember, Representative Moyle, Senator Winder, right, and leadership of the Democrat Party all signed a letter asking, recommending to the committee a 43% pay increase. And, you know, we just, those of us in our little group here, we just looked at that and we just said, there's just absolutely no way that we could accept a 43% increase. And David Levitt, I believe, testified against it. And Faye Thompson, Legislative District 8, she testified against it, and some others. And so the day after the election, the committee met again the morning of the day after the election, and they just arbitrarily brought a number out of thin air that was $25,000. And I think the percentage of that equated out to like 23% increase. And they agreed on that. And again, we just looked at that and, you know, our people in Social Security, they're going to get a 2.5% increase in their Social Security, which doesn't even...
I'm one of those, by the way.
There you go. And I've had several people tell me that like their Medicaid expense has gone up and it will more than eat up that 2.5% increase in their Social Security. So, and I've had people, I have friends who, I have one friend, she's owned her home for over 40 years or has been paying on it. She's almost got it paid off. But even though there was supposed to be some property tax adjustment or rebate or whatever it was called last year, her mortgage went up $130 a month. And she's on a fixed income. And, you know, just stories like this all the time. So to think that the legislature, we just couldn't justify that. And so we ran the resolution and we got it through Senate State Affairs. And then we got it across the floor in the Senate and sent it over to the House. And so this morning, there was a hearing on it in the Ways and Means Committee, and Kent Marmon, Representative Kent Marmon, Legislative District 11, he carried it in that committee. And you know, Bob, that the Ways and Means Committee is the Speaker of the House's committee. That's where, you know, he controls that committee. It's a leadership committee, and what he says goes in that committee.
Doesn't he appoint most of the people for that, or has an influence in doing that?
In the House, the Speaker of the House appoints the committee assignments.
Okay.
In the Senate, they do it a little bit different. They try to base it on seniority. And most of the time that works. Sometimes it doesn't, but most of the time it does work. So the hearing for that resolution was in the Ways and Means Committee this morning. And Representative Monks, the video's out there. Tom Zeidervald live streamed the video onto Facebook, and everybody should watch that video, because it's a good snapshot of how things work. Representative Monks indicated that it's his belief that if we don't pay more, then we don't get good people, which I found completely insulting, because I think we have some pretty good people in the legislature now. You know what the pay is when you take it on. And for many of us, it's not because of the pay. It's not because we're going to get rich. It's an act of service. This is what you do to ensure that future generations of Idahoans can live in peace and safety and abundance. And to even intimate in the slightest that if we don't start paying our legislators more, that we're not going to have good legislators, I found very, very insulting. And so he made a motion to table the resolution, and it died in the Ways and Means Committee this morning. So we tried to get the people of Idaho, you know, to stand up for Idaho values, to not take that pay increase until we could offer some real tax relief for the people of our state. And the Speaker's Ways and Means Committee killed it this morning.
Well, I don't think that a raise of any sort would garner better or more people to run for the legislature. I think that most of the time, that's a call to service from the people that do serve, and it's not a money thing. And if Jason Monks is doing that, I don't know, maybe he's looking to retire as part of the legislature for 20 years, like a lot of these guys have wanted to do. I get really annoyed when we see budgets rising at a huge rate of speed, to the point where we're we've doubled our budget in the last 9 years, from $7 billion to $14 billion, asking for a raise? Excuse me, where is the money coming from? And why is it necessary if you're there to serve the people? You know, they're more like serving themselves when you get a raise of 22 or 43%.
Well, I would agree. And beyond the dollars, beyond the dollar amount, it's a moral issue for me. I mean, to me, it is just an immoral thing to do, to take that kind of a pay increase when our senior citizens and other people across our economy just plainly are not going to get it. And, you know, he made some issue about the way the resolution would work. And incidentally, in 2009, the legislature rejected a pay increase then. And this is the exact verbiage of the resolution that they adopted then to reject the pay increase at that time. So he started this business about, well, you know, this isn't a rejection of that because it doesn't go back. We start technically December, the first week in December. So we have technically received a paycheck for December, and the resolution didn't provide to go back and recapture that. It just moves forward, which has been done before. So he made this big issue about, well, this isn't technically a rejection. This is a reduction, and the resolution's been written wrong and yada, yada, yada. When the resolution provided for that, we would just go forward because of the paperwork and the unwinding and everything to go back and make a difference. And the Constitution just says, we have 25 days from the first day of the session to reject the pay increase. That's what the Constitution says. So, you know, legally and technically, we were well within the law well within the bounds of what's set forward in the Constitution of the state of Idaho to just simply reject the pay increase going forward.
Yeah, so I have to ask you a question. Do you think that most of the legislators, senators, and the House of Representatives actually read our Constitution?
I cannot speak for them, but sometimes I have to wonder. Sometimes I really
thank you.
Have
so
to
do I.
You're welcome. Yeah, so it just, you know, that was our first big push. I guess I'll just not talk anymore and you can ask me more questions.
Well, I understand where you're coming from, because we've seen this happen before. And like I said, we have a runaway budget and it has to be reined in one way or another. But let's go on to something that just hit the news yesterday about Trump taking Senator Rich's advice to stop the destruction of 100,000 acres of lava flats with 700-foot wind turbines. How do you feel about that?
Oh, it's a great day. Anytime you can stop something like that, it's a great day. You know, that's another good example of the voice of the people being heard. And just one last thing I want to say about the pay increase, and then I'll move on to that. There were thousands and thousands of phone calls, emails, text messages, petitions supporting the legislators not taking the pay raise. And the Lava Ridge Project, it's a testament to the involvement of the people in the area. The people in the Twin Falls area and other areas, we've looking at kind of the same thing here in Elmore County where they want to put these windmills in. I mean, they rallied, and people from all walks of life, all political persuasion, they rallied together to stop that. Because
I have to say one thing. You know, AG at Labrador joined a lawsuit trying to get the BLM land back for the state, and it was rebuffed by the Supreme Court. So we're back to, you know, stage one again, where we're not going to get this land back. And the real problem is that the BLM literally runs roughshod over 2 million acres of our land, and they decide what we can and can't do with it. But by the same token, they receive funds every year from grazing or timber or whatever it might be that's on those lands, when that money should actually be going to the state. And what aggravates me and upsets me so much is that we have a governor who has done little or nothing to help get this land back or do something. I mean, he's just been kind of null and void about the whole issue. And I just wondering, is the legislature ever going to try and act on something like this? Are they going to put this up to a vote for the people? Because it has to start someplace. And usually when you want to get things done, it has to start at the grassroots.
Right, right. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate that happened. If you look at it, it's 63%. Of the land area in the state of Idaho is controlled by a federal agency. So that 63% of the resources in the state of Idaho that are not generating income, jobs, a better way of life for the people in our state. I had Owyhee County in my district before, and it is one of the poorest districts in our state. And it has, I think, more federal land than any other county. Did I say district? Any other county in our state. And it's just thievery from the people of the state of Idaho. And, you know, some people get all upset and they say, well, you know, we can't hunt and fish if this happens. And, you know, we won't have access to those lands. No, we would, because we would have jobs. We would have forestry. We wouldn't have the forest fires that we have, because we would be engaged again in the timber industry. We would have more grazing. This is just like the federal government looking at the state of Idaho, the people of the state of Idaho, and saying, you know, too bad, so sad. You don't get to make a living on these lands. And that only happens west of the Mississippi. You know, Nevada has even more public lands than the state of Idaho. As far as the legislature, I wish they would. I'm not 100% sure what it is legislatively we could do, but it definitely needs to be done. And, you know, the payment in lieu of taxes that we are supposed to get from the feds on these managed properties. I speak
32 million acres of them, by the way.
Yes. And our local government entities, our counties and such, the way I understand it, it's unreliable. It's arbitrary. Maybe they'll get it. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll get what's promised. Maybe they won't. So, you know, they're just completely and totally under the thumb of a bureaucratic agency that first knows absolutely nothing about our lands, absolutely nothing about how to manage them, what goes into it, what's important to Idahoans. It's a travesty.
Do you know if anybody's going to try and lobby our new Secretary of the Interior, Doug Burgum?
I haven't heard that yet, you know, but I've been pretty tied up with local issues right now. I haven't heard any rumblings like that, but hopefully.
I'd love to see some of our legislators invite him out to show him how badly our forests have been managed and how it's been hurting Idaho.
Well, I would love to send him an invitation because my legislative district is the biggest in the state and it's the heart of the state. You know, and we have, I don't even know how many acres of forest and the very lands that we're talking about. So I would send you an invitation.
Well, I would love to hear when you do that and let me know what the response is on it. Because we need to do something. We need to do something soon because what's happened in California is coming here.
Yes.
And the governor just put out a press release from a conference he held talking about what's happening in California and basically saying that, well, it's not going to happen here. Well, he doesn't know whether it's going to happen here or not. You know, he thinks that strategically and proactively, we've been reducing the fire risk here in Idaho. And if that's the case, well, why are the Payette and Boise National Forests considered wildfire areas? So mm-hmm. I think he's full of hops. And I think what he's doing is playing another game and not addressing the real issue, which is the problem with the Forest Service. I've talked about this ad infinitum with other people, other legislators, and including Russ Fulcher. And while they all understand what's going on, we still have a governor who does little or nothing to help the cause. And I happen to live in one of those districts where we are and were confronted with fires literally surrounding us in the last fire season. And we have seen our insurance rates double. We have seen areas that were used to be full of wildlife totally devastated. And something has to be done very soon. I know we are working on something here in our own development, which is some 1,000 acres to take the trees out, to reduce the fire hazard and make this place something that we can be proud of because the Forest Service will do nothing to help us, nor will the state nor the counties right now.
Right. Well, and that's just a perfect example of how important local control is. Somebody from halfway across the country or clear on the other side of the country, they have no idea how to manage the assets that are here, how to manage the forests and the grazing lands. Some of them probably have never even seen a cow as far as the grazing and stuff. And this business of, you know, animals and the cows being bad for the environment and all of that, you know, there were bovine in this country long before there were human beings. And so it's just, the rhetoric is just ridiculous. It's just crazy. And I would agree with you that, you know, our governor should, but, you know, in the past with COVID and such, we've seen the kind of stands that he chooses to take.
And
then we can talk about again, but there's no reason to.
Local authorities, you know, our commissioners, they have very little that they can do. You know, I sit on the P&Z commission up here, and we have a land guide, a land use guide that we go by that is supposed to be revised every 10 to 20 years, depending on where you are. And, you know, we're basically agriculture, timber, and we do have some businesses, but it's not extensive. And I find it difficult to get things done because we have people who come in here and they want to exploit the land very much like, you know, the people who come in and want to log the timber. They buy a huge swath of land and they'll be logging it for 3 years. And the next thing you know, they want to subdivide and build homes and change the whole lay of the land, but they never want to put in the infrastructure, which I want to go back to today and talk about. I see so much growth coming here with what's going on in California. I don't know how Idaho is going to handle it, especially down in the Treasure Valley, because this is where you have, I should say, the traffic jam of commerce and industry, where we continue to invite these huge companies to come in and build these monstrous buildings and hire thousands of people. And then we take our agricultural land down there and we turn it into a housing development with 1,000 homes on it. Well, we're going to chew that land up pretty quickly. And when are we going to actually see some actions, not just by the legislature, but by the local planning and zoning committees, to change what's going on and actually put the onus for the infrastructure on the developers who are changing the landscape of the entire valley? I mean, we see it up here. We try to keep it to a minimum of doing crazy things without doing all of the infrastructure that goes with it. I don't see the infrastructure down in the Treasure Valley to handle what's going to happen down there. And people should be afraid that they could run out of water, that they won't have all of the protections they need down there, or the highways to get around. And is the legislature going to address this?
I would agree. The people who are already there and the houses and stuff are already there, they should not have to put the tax bill to put in the infrastructure for new growth and development. That's what impact fees are for. And I'm not up to speed as much as I should be to really discuss this intelligently, other than the fact that I believe that that's how it should be done, that there should be impact fees, that there should not be tax breaks for businesses that come in, because the businesses that come in have an effect on the infrastructure. They have an effect on the growth. And that's part of the reason why our property taxes go up so much. And I think we've probably discussed this before, that you know, people look at the legislature and blame the legislature for skyrocketing property taxes, but the legislature only has so much control over that. Your property taxes are driven by your city and county government budgets. And then there's like a provision for a 3% increase and then some adjustment for inflation. But it's all about spending. And the growth is part of the spending. And so as more infrastructure is needed to be put in and more sewer plants and more roads and this and that, that growth has to be covered from somewhere. And if it's city and county spending, it's covered from your property taxes. And I'm a firm believer in impact fees. I know the city that I came from in Utah, it's still small and quite rural. And they put in an extremely high impact fee because they had no infrastructure. And then people decided that was a place in the valley to start building houses. And at least the city council down there, just real small town, they had the foresight to decide, you know, we can't put this tax burden on the people who are already here. So they did some pretty hefty impact fees before you could build there. And they've been fairly successful with that. It's helped kind of relieve that tax burden on the people that are already there, because it's a forward, I guess a forward tax is a way to look at it, but at least it's not taxing the people that are there.
I'm a firm believer that if you're going to build and you're going to make money on that project, then it's up to you to provide the infrastructure that is necessary to go along with that project, be it roads, be it sewers, be it water, be it electric power, whatever it may be. That's something that should be paid for by those people that are going to be earning the money from the construction of these new developments. I'd like to use this kind of as a segue, because we're talking about taxes, and talk about HB 001, excuse me, which has to do with school choice. and where you stand on this. I had a conversation with Ron Nate in the last week about this, and I find this to be one of the as he says, the gold standard in school choice. Where do you think the legislature, and what's your feeling that where the legislature stands on this particular bill, and do you think it has the merit to get through the legislative process and the governor?
This is a personal bill, so it's not going to go any farther than it is because it has a bill number. I'm on the Education Committee in the Senate, and we had a school choice bill presented yesterday. I believe we have another one going to be presented today. The one yesterday was one that former senator from your area, Stephen Thane. It was his bill, and Senator Lent presented it. Today, the way I understand it, it's a bill that is supported by Debbie Critchfield, Superintendent of Public Education. I'm expecting several more before it's over. But as far as the issue of school choice itself, I'm in favor of school choice. And I know our rural school districts, you know, get really upset about that and feel like that it's going to take money out of their pocket and go to private schools. Well, in most of our rural areas, there aren't any private schools. But I've in my mind, I've just kind of focused this down to one issue. Anytime the government, and I know it's in our Constitution, we're supposed to provide, you know, public education, but it's not specific on what that's supposed to look like, right? It says we, and I don't even know if it says public education, but we're to ensure that there's education for common education for our children. But my issue with all of this is this: if the government sets up one form of education, one place where I can buy my groceries, one place where I can buy my car, and then they tell me, you can't go anywhere but this, that's totalitarianism. And I feel like by not allowing our parents a choice in the way and where they educate their children with their own tax dollars, then we have a real problem. And I'm not saying public education is bad. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that parents have the right to make that choice, because that's what a republic is all about.
Well, I don't disagree with you, but I don't know what kind of a bill Critchfield produced, but she has been against public choice, school choice. And what's happening, and as Trump said yesterday, they are going to eliminate the federal education department, turn it back to the states. How do you think that's going to affect our states? And especially Idaho. You know, we rank at the bottom end of the scale in terms of how our children are learning. And we rank number 50, believe it or not. That's where we were 10 years ago.
Well, I've had teachers in my office all day Monday because it's the Idaho Education Association Day on the Hill. And some of those teachers told me that we rank like 48th in spending per pupil, but that we're scoring like 14th in the nation. And I don't have any of those statistics on my desk. That's what they're saying. But all that being said, I believe that our education system in Idaho is pretty top heavy in that most of the pay goes to administration rather than into our classrooms. Yes. I think that education was set up to be a local issue. That's why we have locally elected school districts. I think one of the other big problems that we have in education on a local level and across our state is 44%, I believe it is, of our state budget is federal money, federal dollars that come in through grants, programs, loans, whatever. And every dollar that comes into our state through a federal program or federal channel of any kind has all kinds of strings, regulations, must-dos, can't-dos, shall-dos. And I think our education system is about as bad as it gets when it comes to that, because it takes away the freedom of the local boards and our local state entities to decide what's best for the education of our children, because we have to meet all of those federal guidelines. So as I'm looking at this and I'm thinking about what money comes into directly into our classrooms through federal grants and stuff. I think if that money goes away, there's going to be a period of transition, because there always is. And we're going to have to figure out better ways or different ways of doing some of this stuff. We might find out that it's more beneficial for the education of our children to just not have that stuff in our classrooms and to allow our teachers to do what they do best. I think in Idaho, we have great teachers, and I think they love their kids, and I think they love what they're doing. But I think sometimes the regulatory burden on them is just like it is on everybody else in our economy today. The federal regulatory burden is so heavy that it's difficult to be able to accomplish what you want to accomplish in the way you want to accomplish it, because you have to meet all these guidelines or you lose the funding. Or if you want this money, you have to do something else that doesn't even apply to the money that you're trying to get. So, you know, it might hurt for a little bit, but, you know, we're resilient and we're not dumb here in Idaho. And I think it's a challenge that can be met and will come out better on the other side.
Well, actually, you've come full circle, because here we go back to the money that the government gives us for the lands that they have. Again, we can't provide the same things for our children that other states can that have the use of their entire lands. And exactly. this is where it all begins for the Western states. And this is why we have the problems we have. It's all back to, why does the government still have 62 or 63% and control that much of Idaho's land? Because this reduces our options and our opportunities. And Lord knows, Idaho has some of the biggest forests and some of the highest content, of rare earth minerals, even of any state that's in the United States. So unless we can get something changed, I fear that when they change and don't have this money coming in from the feds anymore, that we're going to be at a bigger deficit than most people think.
Well, I think we will, because, you know, constitutionally, we have to have a balanced budget. But every time when I was here before in the legislature and we would vote on these budgets, if it were federal money, you know, especially the money that came from COVID, if it had an ARPA money, or, and I can't remember the acronym for the other, there were two pretty big funding sources for that, I would vote against it every time, because it's not free money. And I remember one time on debate on the floor in the Senate, I debated against taking the money, the federal, the ARPA funds, because it's not money that's just grown out of thin air. It's your tax dollars. Just because it has a federal label on it, it's still your tax money. And I debated on the floor that I wouldn't vote for it, because, you know, this is debt money. It's absolute debt money. I've got a little debt calculator here in my office, and I have to keep it plugged in, because it works so hard all the time that the batteries go dead in about 15 minutes. And I had another senator, excuse me, I don't remember who it was, but they stood up and they said, well, you know, if we don't take this money, they'll just send it to California. If we don't spend it, they'll just send it to California, or some other state will spend it. And my thought was, is if there were a drug dealer on the corner, and my child went to that drug dealer and was going to buy drugs, and I said, no, you know, you're not going to, that this isn't appropriate, it's not good for you, it's not healthy for you, all these reasons why that's not a smart choice. And my child looked at me and said, well, if I don't buy those drugs and I don't use them, the kid down the street's going to buy those drugs and use them. It's the same concept. It's not good or smart or healthy for anybody in any reason to become dependent on federal debt dollars. And that's kind of where we're at. So it'll be interesting to see. You know, I think we can do it. I think we need to be careful. We have a lot of rainy day fund in the state of Idaho also that we
mean the $1.3 billion that we have put away?
That would be it. And, you know, our agencies, the way I understand it, have rainy day funds.
See, I look at that money in a different way, more of a caustic way, that this is a way for government to not let go any of their people when we have a downturn. That's what this rainy day fund is for. And I always come back to the fact that Idaho has the largest number of state employees than any other industry in Idaho. We are the biggest employer. And that's got to tell you something.
Well, it does. I had this discussion with someone just a couple of days ago that between state and county and local governments, government is the biggest employer in the state of Idaho. And I'm just not sure that that's a healthy position to be in.
Well, not only is not a healthy position to be in, to be sitting there, you know, with, you know, you say it's $1.3 billion. I believe it's actually more than that, and it gets up around the $2 billion level. You know, everybody says it's a rainy day fund. Let me tell you something. It's been raining here for a while. It's just that nobody has noticed it, and they decided not to put the umbrella up.
Right.
So while we're sitting here looking at our school situation, and we've been throwing money at it left and right, don't get me wrong, but it's been going to the wrong places. It's called mismanagement. And I think that's where we have to change what's going on. I have called for a forensic audit of the Health and Welfare Department and of the Education Department for the last 5 years. We have seen at least a modicum of change in the health, in our health department with the new fellow that just took over. But
right.
We still haven't discovered. Yeah. But we still haven't discovered where the $93 million for the health data exchange disappeared to.
Exactly. And, you know, there are some issues like that across our state. The LUMA program, there's money that is missing there. There was money that went missing in the Department of Health and Welfare. And, you know, those are the only ones that we know about. I'm not making accusations, but I think, like you say, it's so important that we audit, especially those departments that are our biggest expenditures in our state. We really do need a good forensic accountability as to where the money's going, how it's going, and a better way to track it.
Yeah, it's funny. We're required to have a forensic audit within our homeowners association every 5 or 6 years. But the state doesn't have a forensic audit on the important sections of it that it really needs.
Right. You know, the health and welfare budget, because of the Medicaid expansion, that ended up being so very much more than we were told. I didn't vote for it when it came. I was in the House when that happened, and I didn't vote for it. And the numbers right off the bat, I mean, it wasn't, I don't think, 2 weeks after that went into effect that we saw that the numbers that were projected, and I forget, was it Milliman that projected those numbers?
Yes. It was $100,000.
Yeah. You know, and that the people that would go on it, but it didn't take long until we started to get phone calls from people that would say, you know, I don't want to go on this program, but because of the way it's structured and the way it's set up, you know, my insurance company is going to drop me and now I have to do it. And then I think back and remember when President Obama stood there and said, you know, if you like your insurance company, you're going to keep your insurance company. Nobody's going to force you to make a change. And then we start getting all these phone calls and everything about it. And if we're not careful, that in itself could break our state.
Oh, I agree 100%. We're talking about I guess $3 or $4 billion currently that's going into the health and welfare. That's an enormous sum.
Medicaid expansion alone is the biggest share, I believe, of our health and welfare budget. And it just continues to grow by leaps and bounds. And then what happens if the feds decide, which they could arbitrarily do, if they decide to not match at the rate that they're matching and we have to pick any part of that up?
That's the big question. That's what nobody knows.
That's a scary question for me. And that's every time I think about Medicaid expansion, you know, that's what I think, you know, what if, what happens? I just wait for the other shoe to drop there.
Well, there's a lot of shoes that have been dropping lately. So you better go out and see if you can buy a couple of new pair because we're going to be walking around a lot.
Right.
We won't be able to afford to drive anymore. I have one final question for you. We have an election coming up next year. Who do you see running as governor, and will there be any contesting of Governor Little's position?
I think if Governor Little decides to run again, I don't know that he'll have a challenge. I think if he doesn't decide to run, then I, and this is just my personal opinion, but I think Mike Moyle is positioning himself to run. I'm pretty sure about that. I think Speaker or President or Pro Tem, excuse me, I have to call him President on the floor. I think Pro Tem Bedke would make a run for governor. And I'm not sure who all else. You know, there are always other people that do that. But in my mind, if Governor Little doesn't run, those would be my two main suspects for the position.
What about our AG?
I think he would be a really good governor, but I think he's just so outstanding where he is that I would ask him to stay where he is, because I think he's just, you know, he's been what our state has needed for such a long time, because he is not afraid to stand on constitutional principles. And that's so important in that position. And who would we get to replace him? Yeah, we didn't have that in Idaho for such a long time. And it's just such a breath of fresh air to see someone who will really actually get in the ring and join with other AGs across the country and, you know, and really work to stand up for like the unborn or and all of the other issues, like the issue on the federal lands and stuff like that. I think he's done a phenomenal job, just absolutely stupendous. I can't find enough words here to describe how pleased I am with the work that he's done.
I can't disagree with you, and believe me, nobody likes Governor Labrador. Excuse me, and I see there I go slipping a tongue. AG Labrador probably more than I do, and I've worked on three of his campaigns. To me, he is the creme de la creme of not just politicians, but of AGs that we've ever had here. I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us. I know you're about to run out of battery down there. And we don't want that to happen before we finish our conversation. But you're giving us some interesting insight into a couple of things. And we'll see what happens, whether Bedke or Moyle or one of the others decides to run this year. But I want to thank you for your service. And I want to thank you for everything you do in helping make Idaho a better place to live.
Well, I appreciate that, Bob. And, you know, thank you for having me on. I love doing stuff like this. I love talking about the issues that our state faces. And I feel so blessed to be able to be here, to be able to hopefully make a difference, to leave our state in a better position than what I found it for my kids and my grandkids and their kids, you know, on for generations to come. It's a beautiful place to live. You know, we're asset rich and we have, like you said, more rivers than any other state in the country. We have it all. We have the high plains, we have the forests, we have the farmland, you name it, you can find it in Idaho. And what a blessing to be here. And so just thank you so much. And thank you for people who are listening, and God bless you all. And just have a beautiful day.
Well, do me a favor, tell your group of eight that we'd like to have the rest of them on over the next couple of weeks, because while we get into this legislative harangue that's been going on and more and more bills coming up, I'd like to hear more from the conservative side of the street.
I'll get you all their phone numbers, because I'll tell you what, we've got a good bunch. You know, we've got like Josh Cole, who's the youngest person to ever be elected into the state Senate in the history of Idaho. We have Faye Thompson and myself from Legislative District 8. We had a historical event in Legislative District 8. The AG told me this is the first time in the history of the state of Idaho that three incumbents were overturned. That's never happened before in the state of Idaho, from what I'm told. And, you know, and we've got Senator Zeiderveld, who's on JFAC, and I could go on about all of them. Kent Marmon, Lucas Kalier. I'm going to miss some people here, so if I apologize for not mentioning them, but
that's okay.
I will get you their numbers, and you have them on, because they are amazing. And they are the heart and soul. They represent what's good about everything in the state of Idaho.
Well, thank you again, Christy Zitto. Thank you for your service, and God bless you.
God bless you.
Cry. tough as nails.
Yeah, my kind of crazy still running its courses with wild.